I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea. I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today we're going to be talking about something a little bit different from our usual subject, but I think you're going to find this a fascinating conversation, and it turns out it's going to be more important historically than what perhaps we have imagined. We're going to be talking about financial history today, particularly the history of financial bubbles. What causes them? Where have we seen them? And what do they mean for today? Are we in a bubble of sorts today? The conversation we're going to be having is with Aman Verghese. Aman is the founder and general partner at Practical Venture Capital in Palo Alto, California. Pleased to tell me the father of two girls. Myself, the father of a teenage girl, I understand. Also guest lecturer at the Harvard Business School. His bachelor from Stanford University and his JD from the Harvard Law School. Today, though, we're going to be talking particularly about his book. I want to highly recommend it to our listeners for some really interesting historical analysis that's laced through with fabulous stories that will keep you engaged and help you understand more deeply financial bubbles. The book is called A Brief History of Financial Bubbles. Our guest today is Aman Verghese. Aman, thanks for being with us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. Delighted to be on. I guess they say in FM radio, I'm a longtime listener, but a first-time caller, a big fan of the podcast. With my daughter, the 14-year-old likes little tidbits of American history and the American founding, so she likes to listen in from time to time as well. So thank you for that, and thank you for all you do to keep us educated and motivated as Americans.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. The book, A Brief History of Financial Bubbles. You look at, if I'm not mistaken, about 10 different bubbles.
That's right.
That occurred from all the way starting in the 17th century with the Dutch in the Netherlands up through contemporary issues, including things like cryptocurrency and AI. Maybe we should start with the definition for our listeners who are not obviously as accomplished as you are in the world of finance. What do you mean by a bubble?
You know, a lot of people mean different things, as it turns out, when you try to define a bubble. I'm trying to be pretty tight with what I describe, but just really an unsustainable run-up in prices of some kind of financial asset in some time and space. And usually I defined it as a run-up of about five times or more over a couple of years, and then over the subsequent 2 years, it all goes away. So it's an asymmetric, it's a symmetric run-up in prices and run-down. I try to get away from definitions of bubble around just, you know, valuations being high for a period. When we talk about AI or crypto, a lot of folks focus on like fundamentals of the business and how you come detached from fundamentals. That does get often, it does get defined that way in literature, but it's a difficult definition to explain when you try to think through cryptocurrencies and like what fundamentals are you looking at to define what are the fundamentals of a crypto business. It's not obvious. And so I just basically limited it to a run up in prices followed by a run down in prices that looks symmetrical over a short period of time.
When you start in the book, of course, you start with in the 17th century with the Netherlands, or that's the first major sort of case study in there. I think people might be surprised by that as a starting point for a brief history of financial bubbles. What's important about that first episode in your mind for helping us understand this phenomenon?
Well, I picked that one because it was the first time we really saw a defined asset class, in this case, tulips, take that pattern of a tremendous run-up in prices. There's a fascinating set of stories around why that market happened in Amsterdam. Why not London? Why not Paris? Why didn't it happen in 16? What happened in 1636? Why not 1626 or 1646? So I began to look for the causes and the historical and political context that began to lay a pattern for how these bubbles form. So it fit the definition. It was a major increase in the valuations of this asset class. It represented at its peak something like 6 to 10% of Dutch GDP at the time. Just for context, the US is $30 trillion economy. So imagine a $3 trillion asset class arriving almost, you know, and with a within about four or five years, having got most of that value created, and then very, very quickly going away. And the market behavior and the dynamic of what happens at the top of markets and why people get excited in that and participate in that run up, I thought were one, fascinating. And then two, just a good understanding of a pattern that would occur over and over and over again in history.
I think people are going to are fascinated to know what in the world happened in 1636.
I'll give you the short story of it. So the Dutch at the time were the richest country in the world, in Europe. They were just at the height of their trading power as an empire. So there's a lot of money. And one of the patterns I find in these bubbles is that they usually happen in the richest city in the world, or at least in the largest economy, the most successful economy, and in the financial center of the world at the time. That was true of Amsterdam in 1636. It was true of London in the 1800s, where there were two other bubbles that I looked at. I looked at New York, 1929, Japan in 1984. The recurring pattern is general increase in prosperity that's rapidly felt is usually one of the precipitating causes. If the wealth concentrates into a small group of people, that's another cause. And then a little bit of easy money, whether it's a central bank, whether it's a financial innovation, that's usually the third piece that falls in place. And that's when the bubble happens. In the case of Amsterdam, there were a trading empire that had accrued a tremendous amount of wealth. The seafarers had accumulated a lot of wealth into a relatively small group of a new merchant class that became very, very wealthy. Different from maybe Paris or London, they didn't have a lot of places to spend their money. In Paris, you could spend money, if you were wealthy, on clothing, on silks, on furniture for houses. That was all acceptable. It was what the aristocracy did. Not so in the Netherlands. It was a Puritan culture. There are lots of stories about English travelers who go to Netherlands at the time. And they come back and they say they can't tell the difference between the richest man in town and the peasants because they all dress alike. They have the same types of clothes. So what did you do with your money? Well, what was acceptable in the culture was you can buy a country garden house. What do you put in a garden? Flowers. The tulips had recently come over from Turkey. They were rare. They were beautiful. And they were the cause of great desire. And then through other market dynamics and some financial innovations from the Dutch stock exchange, notably forward contracts, a little bit of easy money began and sophistication began to fuel the tulip market. And in 1636, the market began to go, it doubled every 3 to 6 months for a period of about a year and a half. It peaked at a price where the most expensive house on the Amstel River in Netherlands would command about the same price as a Dutch tulip bulb. So the most valuable flowers were worth
an entire house.
And to buy, and the average price for these very rare flowers at the peak were it's like six times the salary of a merchant at the time. And then all of a sudden, in February of 1637, it all kind of went away. There were a couple of failed auctions. All of a sudden, fear set in, and the market just rolled out. You know, like the cold fog of an Amsterdam winter. If you've ever been to Amsterdam, you know what I mean. How the weather changes. It just happened that quickly, and the market just collapsed within a matter of days. And it fell by 90% within a matter of about a week.
Were the same factors present? Because one of the things you talk about in the book is there might be similar patterns, but there are differences in each of these episodes so that we need to understand similarities, but also differences. And then what about, do we say the same factors present in, for example, the South Sea bubble or right. The English railroad boom of the next two centuries?
Yeah, there were similar factors in the case of the railway boom in the 1840s. It was very different from the tulip bubble. One of the things that I point out in the book is that you get useful bubbles and then destructive bubbles. And there are two technology bubbles that I point to, the 1840s tech boom in the UK being one with the rise of the railway. And the other is in the United States, the tech boom in the late 1990s, where you get a new technology that animates people, that creates a lot of excitement. And that is the precipitating factor for a lot of investment into a new category. And if the country is doing well at the time and there's a lot of wealth that's been accrued recently and you get some easy money, then those are all the factors that seem to happen. In the case of the 1840s, there was easy money from the Bank of England, which for the first time in 150 years cut its discount rate, its interest rate to about 2.5%. It had never done that before. And that was one of the things that then caused that investment in railways to increase. And the market got very excited about the prospect of railways. The transportation in England at the time was very inefficient. It would take like 6 days to travel from London to Liverpool, for instance, by horse and by carriage, by very, very difficult roads. And that was all being cut in half by the advent of railway or passenger trains, or even by more. Just for context, to go from London to Paris was not 6 days. It was more like a day and a half or 2 days over the water. So the London economy was much closer, much more closely linked to Paris than it was to Liverpool or the north of London. So this revolutionizing new technology happened, a lot of excitement about its possibility and the profits. Market gets carried away, Bank of England cuts interest rates, and you get this big boom in railways. And then very quickly, the market gives up all those gains. There was something similar, as you said, the South Sea Bubble is a very different story. It was it's a very exciting one if you want to know more about that one, in the Mississippi Bubble. But it was a company built by England to create a monopoly, a trade route monopoly between England and the South Seas, which was Latin America around the Orinoco River, the Spanish Empire in South America. They gave that company the exclusive monopoly on those trade routes, made it very, very valuable, sort of like the East India Company at the time. But they told the South Sea Company, there's a bargain here. You have to take on the debt of the English Empire in order to have this monopoly. And by becoming a large holder of our debt, we, the government of England, are going to be better off, because now we have one place to go to issue all our debt. It's a favorable investor. We don't have to, it's a way to raise money in order to finance the wars or pay down debts from prior wars. So the South Sea Company became this very protected government monopoly. Again, a lot of hype and a lot of excitement around the prospects for the company. Just like with the UK railway boom, you know, it didn't, those profits didn't really materialize within the time frame people thought. The difference is, in the UK railway boom, you had a lot of profits eventually coming from railways. It just took a long time for them to materialize. The investors were kind of let down in the interim. Same with the US tech boom. The South Sea Company never made it. It was really all hype, a little bit of fraud at the top of the market, and some very easy money from really the Bank of France, as well as the Bank of England, that helped fuel the boom. So as you said, every story is a little bit different. The emphasis on those factors is a bit different. There's some interesting personalities in each one who always play a role as well.
Of course, one of the episodes that you talk about will be very familiar to our American listeners is the stock boom in the 1920s in the United States. And then, of course, right, the market crash in the late 20s and early 30s. Talk about that as a financial bubble, because there has been a lot of debate, as you know, among historians over the causes and character of the stock market crash.
Yeah, the 1929 stock market crash, it is, it comes soon after the establishment of the Federal Reserve, which began in 1913 in response to a bank panic. You might remember that the United States from 1791 through about 1913 didn't really have a central bank in the modern sense. There was a first bank in the United States, which was the result of the debate between Hamilton and Jefferson and the nature of that bank. As that bank was formed, it was very, very limited in terms of what it could do. It didn't control monetary policy or the money supply. In 1913, the Federal Reserve was created, and it does have control over the money supply and over interest rates. And that bank is then used in the First World War to help finance the World War. They then begin to consolidate their power and figure out open market operations and stuff that's more familiar with the central bank in the 1920s. The economy is booming. You get the roaring 20s. There's a lot of technology that happens in the 1920s. At the beginning of that decade, is, for instance, 6% of Americans own a car. By the end of the 1920s, 60% of Americans live in a household with a car in it. The proliferation of the radio, all the manufacturing and the assembly line technologies that Henry Ford and others bring to fruition happens in the 1920s. Culture has changed dramatically. You get the talkies, movies that actually have a sound and dialogue beginning in about 1926, 1927 at feature length. And so there's a lot of excitement and a lot of enthusiasm in the country in the 1920s. The economy is growing about 4.5% annual GDP with really no price inflation. And the stock market goes up sixfold from 1922 to 1930. So a long, long, prosperous increase in the material and wealth of the American people. The Federal Reserve, now the question is what happens, right? And up until really in the 1950s, I'm not even sure people fully understood what happened. A professor at Harvard, John Kenneth Galbraith, writes a bestseller about the Great Depression in 1954. And in that book, he goes back and he says, even today, economists don't really understand what happened. You know, the market, the market went down. There was a mini recession in 1929, but there've been recessions before. They didn't precipitate decade-long depressions in the stock market, but that went down by 80 to 90% from their peak. So historians debate it to this day, he says, in the 1950s. Well, beginning in the 50s, Milton Friedman began to figure out the principal cause for the Great Depression. And I think he's very convincing about this. And what he says is it's the Federal Reserve and their policy in the end of the 1920s. It allowed the money supply to contract between 1929 and 1933 by about a third. And as a result of that, the economy declined by about a third. The unemployment rate goes up to, at its peak, in the mid-20s. The stock market loses 80% of its value. And so that's Milton Friedman's explanation for the cause of the Great Depression. And generally speaking, I find that very convincing. There are a couple of other potential causes. One is the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which happens in 1930. A lot of economists look at that as being a precipitant to a trade war. That those tariffs then caused, first of all, prices to go up. Second of all, other countries to retaliate. There was also a really big tax increase in 1932. Herbert Hoover pushed that through, signed it. It took the top tax rate, for instance, from 25% to 63%. So a lot of potential causes of, you know, of that depression as a result of bad government policy. What I argue in the book is that it's probably mostly the Federal Reserve, but some of these other things kick in as well. And, you know, I'm not just an economist, Jeff. I'm also a market participant. I'm an investor and I've worked on Wall Street. And I'll tell you, when things begin to go wrong with investors, confidence goes away and all this stuff sort of feeds on itself. And we've seen that in, you know, in markets, even when the Fed and tax policy is constructive, markets just have this volatility. And it's what John Maynard Keynes would have called animal spirits back in 1936. My daughter doesn't know what animal spirits are, but when I ask her about the stuff, she says, it's just vibes, daddy. You know, these vibes of the market kind of went away. And it feeds on itself into this cataclysmic collapse in the stock market. And economic activity follows. And I think a lot of that is the money supply. And the economy doesn't pick up until, you know, 1940, 1941, when we're in World War II.
That's a very interesting part of the book. And it really, it does raise the question, and the way you've put it here, kind of financial bubbles, causation. It seemed like there are multi-causes. And some of it is the market. But some of it is government intervention or bad government policy. Is that right? Say?
Yes, I think so. In particular, you can see it with the money supply decisions made by the government around controlling the money supply. When they get too easy for too long, it is a cause of the bubble, and then they have to correct, and that causes the downturn in the bubble. You know, that 1929 stock market crash, what a lot of people may not know or realize is in 1928, with the economy booming and everything, you know, going in the right direction, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates in 1928. They cut by 50 to 75 basis points. And there were reasons why they did it. The UK asked them to. The UK was struggling at the end of that decade, and they wanted the US to lower rates in order to preserve and maintain their gold standard. But that fueled the end of the bubble in 1929 and the big stock market boom. In the late 1990s, the same thing, a very similar thing happened, actually. And not people don't really remember the internet bubble and what happened. But at the end of 1996, the U.S. is growing. There's low inflation. Everything is sort of heading in the right direction. The tech boom is taking hold. There's some real exciting, the stock market's at an all-time high based on like price-earnings ratios. Alan Greenspan in 1996 gives a speech to the American Enterprise Institute, and he says, I wonder if there's a irrational exuberance, you know, setting into markets right now. And if so, what should I do about it? And he doesn't do anything about it because I think Greenspan was a very free market kind of guy who didn't really want to mess with markets and tell people what the prices were. But he definitely put the market on notice. And the market ran right through that stop signal, to use a baseball metaphor. And then in 1997 and 1998, Greenspan, rather than holding interest rates steady and letting it play out, he actually cuts interest rates by three times in late 1998. And again, there are reasons why he did it, and there are reasons why it sounded right. There was a hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management that was about to go bankrupt. Relatively small hedge fund, but a lot of trading volume with big banks, and the counterparty risk was freaking out the banking system. And so the stock market in the summer of 1998 began to waver. And rather than letting that play out and have a, you know, a healthy correction, he intervened. He cut interest rates. They took Long-Term Capital Management into receivership. That made the banks very happy, I guess. But from the end of 1998 to March of 2000, the market doubled. From its already historic highs, it just doubled. and created a lot of speculative companies that are going public in 1999 and 2000 with cheap money. And then that all ended, relatively badly. So the inability to hold that steady tiller on the money supply, and we see it today, even with today's Fed, right? The economy is doing relatively well by a lot of standards. They're cutting interest rates. They're being goaded to cut interest rates by President Trump. These are all repeating patterns that have happened before.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
When you see, for example, the dot-com bubble, you talked before about useful versus destructive bubbles. And I take it that the dot-com bubble might be an example of a useful bubble in the sense that there's a lot of easy money chasing investment, but some of the investments are in companies that do end up creating value and enduring over time, or at least adding something significant technologically, for example, to the American economy.
Yeah, that is the argument I make, is I really call that one out as a productive bubble. And the reason was there was a lot of investment catalyzed in the late 1990s into new technologies. And there's no doubt that the market, it was a bubble by my definition, meaning the valuation of the market went up and then came right back down again. And the NASDAQ, for instance, gave up 78% of its peak value from March of 2000 to early 2002. So a lot of people got hurt. And a lot of investors who jumped into the bubble in that period would have lost their money. But look at the result of the technology. The technology lasted far longer than the investment. A lot of companies that are in the Magnificent Seven today were founded during that bubble. NVIDIA was founded in 1993. Google was founded in 1998. Amazon was founded in 1995. So all these companies that are market leaders today, creating all this new technology, were created during that bubble. As a result of that investment, their businesses were accelerated. Even out of the bubble, I was at PayPal in 1999-2000. The two founders of PayPal were Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. They came out of the bubble with PayPal being one of the survivors. That's another one of the winners, along with eBay and along with Salesforce and all kinds of other companies that are doing great today came out of the bubble. But the PayPal founders, Elon Musk, went on to found SpaceX and Tesla. Peter Thiel was the first institutional check into Facebook. So a lot of the companies that are making America a leader in technology today owe their success and owe their initial investment, or at least the acceleration of their business, to the bubble. And the reason I think it's productive is when you don't have this enthusiasm that brings all the money into the market, it's entirely possible the companies, the incumbents, just won't invest. If you're a market leader like Google, you don't really want to invest in something that can disrupt your own magnificent search engine with its monopoly profits. You're going to be forced, to do that by somebody who really threatens the franchise, OpenAI or Anthropic. And so you can ask today, are we in an AI bubble? And I'd say, well, we can argue about that in a second, but even if we are, that's okay. It's going to bring a lot of investment, maybe a rational investment, into a couple of disruptors. Those disruptors will enforce Google and Gemini and all the incumbents, whether it's Facebook and Llama, to take their AI businesses seriously. They are maybe irrationally predisposed to not want to invest because of the innovator's dilemma, but this is a way of getting them to foster and create a new technology that ultimately will create a lot of value for them, for us, for consumers. There'll be winners and losers, but on net, there'll be a lot of benefit.
Before we get from 2000 to now, The example that I was also struck by is, and I'm wondering if this is an example simply of a destructive bubble or not, is the subprime lending bubble, which we know from 2008, 2009. What's your analysis of that?
Yeah, that one I think is a, that one would be a destructive bubble. I think that one was an example of bad government policy. That was, if you look at the, if you look at what happened there, the mainstream media narrative around that is that that bubble, which happened around real estate and financial derivatives with, you know, credit rating agencies exhibiting a lot of bad behavior, it bid up the prices of real estate. And then a lot of that value went away. And when you have land or something that's, you know, that's like or housing that doesn't have long term value, it's not really a productive bubble. So that's distinct from the internet or the UK railway phenomenon. And so that is an example, I think, of when where a lot of value was created and then destroyed. The economy then went into a very difficult recession in 2009, 2010. That's very different from the recession in 2001 after the tech bubble, which was a very light recession. There were no valuable companies created in the aftermath of 2009, 2010. And now we have a 15-year and counting shortage of housing. So all kinds of bad things, I think, have flowed from that bubble. When I looked at it, I actually looked at why, one thing I do in the book is I go and figure out, like, why did it happen in this time and space? So before I get into all the causes, why did it happen in the US in 2008-9? Why didn't it happen 10 years prior, or did it happen in other countries? It turns out there were four countries where we had a bubble: US, Ireland, the UK, particularly Northern Ireland, and then Spain. We didn't have similar bubbles in Canada, where I grew up. We didn't have similar bubbles in France, Germany, Italy, Japan, China. So what did those four countries have in common? And it turns out that in all four countries, they had a government housing policy that used affordable housing targets or quotas from the government, and they were placed upon lenders. And these quotas encouraged money to go into low-income borrowers to increase home ownership. And that was the that's the thing that happened across those four countries that didn't really happen everywhere else. The genesis of this really goes back to the 1992 law called the Federal Housing Enterprises Financial Safety and Soundness Act. And it directed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to deploy 30% of their purchases in the loan market to low-income and medium-income households. So Fannie and Freddie are two.
I was just going to say, so what it means is you government policy across these four countries, that's really interesting. I didn't know that, was directing financial institutions toward what we might call bad risk investments in housing.
Yes, exactly. Up until 1992, the U.S. didn't do that. There were federal agencies that existed in before 1992 that were created mostly around the Great Depression, but they were supposed to stabilize the loan market. They were supposed to provide liquidity to the loan market. They weren't telling lenders whom to lend to or even what criteria to use. If anything, they were very strict. They wanted banks to maintain high standards. In fact, the practice of redlining in the United States began or was very prevalent in the 1930s because the federal government was telling banks not to lend to certain communities where there were high concentrations of minority homeowners because they didn't think that would be a good risk. So in the 1960s and 70s, you get the advent of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And these are two large agencies that were created to improve the liquidity of the housing market. They're participating in the secondary market. So what they do is they go to banks who've already made loans. And they say to those banks, let us buy those loans from you. That'll help you manage your risk and reduce your balance sheet. And you can use that capital to then make new loans and, you know, make the market work better. Fannie and Freddie, by the time you get to the 1990s, both of them are publicly traded companies. So they're profitable. They're acting like private enterprises, making money. They're not just an instrument of government policy. But beginning in 1992, they're told by Congress that you have to make a certain percentage of your loans available to only people who are low income or middle income. So at or below the median income in the community in which you live. In 1992, the quota set at 30%, and that's under George Bush. It then goes under Bill Clinton. He gets by the end of the 1990s, it's up to a 50% quota. And then George Bush Jr. takes over, but the same policy maintains. By 2006, 2007, 56% of Fannie and Freddie purchases are going towards these low and middle income households. And so the result is, as you said, a lot of that money now goes towards more, not necessarily, the government would quibble with the bad risk scenario, but it's certainly low income. And what happens when you tell a bank to start lending money to people with lower incomes is they have to work a lot harder to then qualify the credit risk. And they had, for a while, it worked in the 1990s, and then they began to run out of low-income households they could lend to. And then they began offering teaser rates and you know, lowering the down payment amount. And they started going from 10% down to 5% down to 3% down to no money down. That all begins in the late 1990s, early 2000s. One more thing happens around 2002, 2003, which will sound familiar, but it's a consequence of easy money. The interest rates up until 2000, the Fed was holding the rates at about 6.5%, their overnight rate, which if you talk to people today, you know, who think interest rates are fairly high at 3.5% to 4%, 6.5% doesn't sound like cheap money.
Right.
It sounds like reasonable money. Well, after 9/11, the Fed cuts the interest rate and they cut it all the way down to 1.75% in 2002. In 2002, it's sort of you can kind of imagine that as an emergency measure. The markets are going through a liquidity crisis at the end of 2001. 9/11 has just happened. The economy is in a recession in 2001. So you can sort of justify lowering the rates to sub 2% for a little while as an emergency measure. 2002, the economy begins to pick up. 2003, the economy is back almost to full employment. But the Fed keeps interest rates low, below 2%, all the way until 2003, 2004. And by then, now they're taking a lot of bad loans that the government has encouraged banks to produce. They've now fueled that with easy money, super low interest rates, which artificially reduce the default rate and, you know, put a lot more risky debt onto the balance sheets of banks. By 2006, it all comes home to roost. By 2007, you get this default rates begin to pick up. And then really, it's the US, UK, Northern Ireland, and Spain, those four countries where he had similar policies around affordable housing that generate the bubble.
You have mentioned already, but I think our listeners today wonder, when you talk about the factors that have created bubbles in the past, whether it's market factors or government policy factors, people are thinking about immediately our current situation here in 2026, crypto and AI, bubbles or not?
Well, I would say no. Let's start with AI, which I think is more the easy one. You could make a case, I think, that there's a pattern around the productive bubbles I talked about. A new technology that's tremendously useful, and it is getting a lot of investment ahead of the fundamentals or where the business is. And we've seen a big run-up in valuations here in Silicon Valley, where I live, and private companies touting AI businesses. There's definitely a lot of froth and excitement in the market. And so I'm not ruling out that some companies are not going to make it, or that there will be a downdraft in the market, or that a lot of investors, you know, won't lose their money. What I would say, though, is compare this to 1999. The stock market in 1999, let's take the NASDAQ 100 as an example, which is the tech-heavy weighted business in the NASDAQ. The average price-earnings ratio in 1999 was 73 times, so a 73 PE ratio at the end of 1999. Today it's about 26, 27. So the valuation in the market is a lot less. The businesses are real, they're profitable, they're generating cash flow. So that's just one, the valuation environment is different. A second difference is the company in the middle of everything in 1999 was Cisco. And they were building networks and routers to build the internet. And their biggest customers were telecoms. Well, the telecoms, as it turned out, were not profitable. We thought they were, but they ended up restating financials and going through accounting scandals. And by 2001, it turned out that they were not. Global Crossing and others ended up declaring bankruptcy. Enron happened right around there. And so the telecoms were not a reliable customer. Today, the company in the middle of everything is NVIDIA. NVIDIA is selling to the hyperscalers, so Microsoft and Meta and Amazon and Alphabet. Cisco was trading at 200 times earnings back in 1999. NVIDIA is at 25 times earnings. The telecoms were unprofitable, cash flow negative, had $300 billion in debt at the time and went through accounting scandals. These hyperscalers like Amazon and Meta and Microsoft are trading at about 30 times earnings, 25 to 30 times earnings. They're profitable. They're kicking off cash flow. They're paying dividends. They're buying back stock. NVIDIA has bought back $112 billion in stock in the last 5 years, as a for instance. Those hyperscalers have net cash on their balance sheet of $400 billion. The telecoms have $300 billion of net debt. So we're not talking about indebted customers buying something from, you know, a company like Cisco at a peak valuation. It's a very different atmosphere. And the last thing is, a lot of the fiber that was laid in 1999 was dark. Like a lot of the technology that was laid, the broadband network, the fiber optic cable laid in 1999 wasn't being used. In 1999, only 3% was being used. 97% was dark. Why were they building it? Well, they thought the demand would come. Very similar to the UK railway boom in 1845. All kinds of track was laid between 1845 and 1850, 1851. So much so that 90% of it wasn't being used. They had projections. Oh, the demand will come. Remember what I said about London and Liverpool? People will want to go from London to Liverpool in 6 hours, not 6 days. Well, the revenue from those companies doubled from 1845 to 1852. And it doubled again until 1859. So the demand did happen, but they built so much supply that even that increase in demand didn't justify the business cases. And the same thing happened with the internet. The internet, eventually the demand got there, but it just, all that fiber that was laid in 1999 didn't immediately light up. Today, there is so much demand for AI. NVIDIA, every GPU that NVIDIA rolls off its assembly line, it lights up. And there's demand from all these different hyperscalers and all kinds of mid-sized companies for AI that were actually constrained on the supply side. So it's a demand-led boom, not a supply-side boom. So I think those are the major factors where I would say AI is real, whereas the internet bubble, it's very different from the internet bubble in that respect.
And what about crypto?
I would say, I think Bitcoin is real. This might be an example of a Dutch tulip asset bubble. You know, crypto doesn't have the obvious use that GPUs and the internet has. It's not useful in terms of a consumer technology. Why do you want to own it? Well, I guess if you're if you believe that currencies will be devalued and you want to hedge against inflation or against fiat currency, maybe there's some value to crypto, but it's not an obviously useful technology. But I think Bitcoin is an example of something where there is real demand for it, just like gold. I mean, gold isn't particularly useful either, but people do use gold and central banks buy gold, and there's some logic to it. I think Bitcoin might be the kind of asset that has continuing demand. It'll be very volatile. It doesn't have any inherent value, but like digital gold, you know, maybe there's a reasonable case for wanting to own it in your portfolio. I don't feel the same way about any other cryptocurrency. We've actually avoided buying them. I would probably advise, you know, my investors and friends to avoid any non-Bitcoin cryptocurrency until or unless it really has a use, like it's a medium of exchange or something that has some kind of useful technology value. But that would be my distinction in the crypto market.
So when people read this, as you say, they're going to get one important insight to me, the useful bubbles versus destructive bubbles. But for our listeners who are thinking about this history of financial bubbles, what's maybe lesson's too strong a word, but maybe an insight for them and author or for you in the field actually practicing venture capital investment? What's an insight that you take away and should be taken away from this history of financial bubbles?
Well, as an investor, what I think is, even if there's a bubble, meaning a run up and a run down in assets, if you're a long-term investor, and we are 5 and 10 year investors by the nature of our funds, there's a lot of value to be created in the productive bubbles. And the optimal strategy is usually to buy the assets, hold for the long term. If there is a drawdown, you invest into the downturn. If you had done that in 1999 with just pick a basket of internet companies, probably 9/10 of those companies would have gone bankrupt between 1999 and 2002. But the survivors would have included folks like Amazon, folks like PayPal and eBay, folks like Salesforce and NVIDIA, and folks like Meta. And you would have gotten a lot of benefit in the long term by holding those companies. And if you invested in 2002, 2003, 2004, you would have actually enhanced your returns and you would have beaten the market. So, and the same would have been true in the 1840s with the UK tech bubble. Now, would not have been true in 2008 with the subprime bubble. You probably wanted to avoid REITs and real estate assets in 2006, 7, 8, 9, 10, maybe 11 as well. And so you do have to draw a distinction, I think, between the valuable ones that create value and then the destructive ones that don't. And so if you think that AI, I think AI could be an example of a creative bubble, and it's one that we would want to invest in, buy and hold. Don't worry about the ups and downs and, you know, the market froth. There are types of company, when the market goes away and the bubble pops, it's a lot harder to raise money. So the kind of company that'll survive and thrive in the aftermath is a company that's making money profitable or has a path to profitability. You know, PayPal was able to do that. We went through the bubble. We got a lot of money. We got valued, overvalued. The valuation then came undone, but the employees like me who stuck around, we were making money. So we never needed to go and raise money and dilute shareholders. By 2010, a decade later, I was still at the company. We were, you know, we were by then the leader in the payment space, and the company was very valuable, and PayPal is still around today. It's a $50 billion market cap company. We went public in 2002 at $1.5 billion. Just for context. So had you invested in 2002, you would have done fine. Now you would have been, there might be times when it feels scary to invest as the market is dropping, but that's where, you know, conviction is. And the lesson to me is, if you're a policymaker, is just, for the most part, don't do anything. Don't mess with bubbles. Don't try to guide them. Don't try to steer them in the direction you think is right. Don't try to second guess the market. Usually when you try to do that with easy money and the policy tools you have at your disposal, you end up making things worse and you end up destroying a lot of value. And a lot of these bubbles are creative. And so there will be winners and losers, but the net is a benefit. And so rather than trying to pick and choose those winners, letting that bubble play out and not getting in its way is actually the better strategy. So that, as a policymaker, that is, I think, the lesson that you get from these is how not to screw it up is a valuable lesson. And just having a bias towards letting these things play out and let the market correct itself is a valuable lesson.
Well, fantastic words of wisdom for us, both personally and on the policy side. Not always easy for policymakers to leave things alone, as you know, but good advice and historically grounded. What an interesting conversation today. For our listeners, the book is A Brief History of Financial Bubbles by our guest, Aman Verghese. Aman, thanks for being with us today on The American Idea.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcast, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.